What is democracy? How should we think about democracy for this discussion as we move forward?
Right. Well, democracy is a form of political regime. I think it has five characteristics. First is free and fair elections. Second, at least in the contemporary era, you have to have almost universal adult suffrage. Third, protection of rights and civil liberties. Fourth, there have to be accountability institutions that can check executive power. And fifth, armed actors should not dictate policy outcomes. So all of these you can think of as continuous variables, and democracy itself is a continuous variable. It's not a dichotomous variable. It's not something that you either completely have or that you completely don't have. Rather, there are gradations of democracy.
Is there a country that that you see today which you feel like is like the closest form to which at least you feel is like, you know, is like the ideal democracy according to you? Is there a country like that for you?
Well, probably the countries that have the highest level of democracy today in the world would include Canada, New Zealand, Australia, Sweden, Denmark, Finland.
It's because of the, is it because of the characteristics, those few characteristics that you mentioned, you think they have those in like a good, like, you know, in good quantity? Is that exactly. Why? Or do you...
Exactly.
Understood. Is democracy desirable for people? Why should people care about their country being democratic? Also, do you think democracy is like the best form of governance?
Well, I do think that as a general rule, democracy is the best form of government. Winston Churchill famously said that democracy, I don't remember the quote exactly, but it's something like democracy is the worst form of government except all of the others that have ever existed, which is very witty and I think pretty accurate too. You know, the social science evidence shows that democracy on average is considerably better than authoritarian regimes for a wide range of important outcomes. These include economic growth, health outcomes for adults, health outcomes for children. This doesn't mean that all democracies are better than all authoritarian regimes. You know, if you were a poor person in Singapore in 1960, you would be amazed the transformation of Singapore under an authoritarian regime in the last 60 years. And likewise, if you were in Germany in 1932, you might be extremely disappointed with the results of democracy since 1919. But having said that, on average, democracy is better for a wide range of substantive outcomes. And where democracy has an especially decisive advantage is the protection of rights. By definition, democracy protects rights, and authoritarian regimes violate rights to varying degrees.
The example of Singapore is something I think that keeps coming up, you know, like an authoritarian state, which, you know, ended up doing a lot for its people. Do you think that is kind of an aberration? And, you know, in general, I mean, it's just one example, but broadly, authoritarian regimes are generally bad. And, you know, Singapore is just one case where, you know, it's turned out pretty okay.
Well, if you look at Singapore and think of it as the average case, you're cherry picking data. Totally. Right? I mean, the social science evidence about these other substantive outcomes is pretty clear. It's occasionally disputed, but it's pretty clear. Another example of an authoritarian regime that has been great at promoting economic growth is, of course, China. Right? I mean, over the last approximately 45 years, China transformed from an extremely poor country to a middle-income country. Within China, economic development varies widely. You know, the western part of China is still very poor, but on average, China has done a great job at growing the economy. But then you have other cases like Zimbabwe, or so there are these cases where, you know, you've had authoritarian rulers who have been predatory. So they've, you know, these are very corrupt regimes. The rulers have enriched themselves, but they've ruined their countries.
So I think there was this, as before China, you know, became the super, like the economic power that it is today, I think when it joined the WTO, I think there was this wide belief that once China becomes more economically sufficient, or it becomes economically more developed per se, then it would also move towards more political reforms and maybe social reforms per se, which kind of has not happened. I think this is also a strain, if I'm not wrong, my understanding is this is also like a strain of the modernization theory. Why do you think this has, what are your thoughts on, you know, on China not you know, opening up socially or politically per se, and on your thoughts on maybe modernization theory as well?
Right. No, it's an excellent question. So first, in general, on modernization theory, you know, you get modernization theory right. However, the connection between the level of development, usually as measured by per capita GDP, and the level of democracy, it exists, but it's not overwhelmingly powerful. As it happens, I just looked at the data yesterday, and if you look at the 2021 varieties of democracy scores, the most recent report, the level of liberal democracy, and do a crosstab with the per capita GDP, the 2021 World Development Indicators estimate. Do you know what R squared is? So R squared is the percentage of variance explained by variables, by covariates. And so the R square is about 0.32. That means that, you know, yes, there is a connection. It's a meaningful connection, but it's not a tight connection. So, you know, Singapore is an extreme outlier, a very, very rich country that's also quite authoritarian. Back to your question about China. I mean, China in this respect is not an aberration. Anyone who thought that modernization would inexorably lead to democratization in China, I think that was just a complete delusion. And of course, over the last decade, China has taken an authoritarian turn. It always had an authoritarian regime, but it's become more authoritarian over the last decade. In this, you know, if Singapore in this respect is a super interesting case, because it became extremely wealthy and is still very authoritarian. At the opposite end of the spectrum, your country, India, is maybe the most interesting example in the world, right? I mean, India at independence in 1947 was a very, very poor country. If you looked at the best available democracy indicator, varieties of democracy, it's called, it shows India as having, you know, not a high level of democracy in 1947. But yet, I think it's correct, if we think about democracy as a dichotomy, to say that India, most of the time, you know, from 1947 until 1975, was a democracy. And most of the time since 1977, it has again been a democracy. And it's still very, very far from a wealthy country. Of course, India has generated a large number of billionaires in the last two decades. But the average level of wealth in India would still not, even today, predict India being a democracy.
On the you touched upon this a little bit, but if you can polish this, or if you have anything more to say on the relationship between per capita income of a country with relation to maybe them being a dictatorship, or if they on that nation tilting towards dictatorship or democracy, is there any relation there?
Well, I mean, on this point, the political scientists are a little bit divided, but most of the evidence suggests that a high level of income protects existing democracies, but does not have an impact on whether a country will transition to democracy. So if you're a rich democracy, the likelihood of a breakdown is low. There are a couple exceptions in the last decade. But if you are a rich authoritarian regime, according to the majority opinion today, the likelihood that you will transition to democracy is no greater than if you were a poor authoritarian regime.
Mm-hmm. So people hoping for, you know, Saudi Arabia or let's say Singapore to move towards democracy probably are going to be disappointed, no?
Yes. I mean, at some point, of course, you know, could they transition to democracy? Of course. But has modernization radically increased the chance that that will occur? Most of the evidence says no.
Also, I'm just curious, from Singapore's perspective, or maybe from a rich authoritarian government or nation state perspective, as a citizen of that country, maybe as a citizen of Singapore, when things are economically, when things are going so are going so well, and you look at maybe other countries, let's say you look at India, where there's a lot of democracy, but you know, economic wise, they're not doing pretty well. We're not doing pretty well. Or you look at other nations, maybe in Africa or maybe in Eastern Europe, let's say, there might be democracy, but you know, economically, the countries might not be doing very well. So would they not feel that, you know, we have a good thing going on, and, you know, even though there might be some rights that are missing, but we're doing pretty okay compared to the rest of the world, and, you know, we would like to stay this way?
Yes, if I were a citizen of Singapore, I would probably think, what's happened in my country over two or three generations is amazing. I don't want to lose it. But you also have to remember that Singapore is a real outlier. Most authoritarian regimes have predatory leaders who engage in predation to remain in power. And these regimes, you know, on average, they do worse for their citizens than the average democracy.
Understood. I want to go back to China, in the sense that now that China is an economic, if I can say so, it's an economic superpower. What does that mean for, let's say, countries that are looking at China? And I mean, that are looking at China and saying, or maybe thinking that, you know, we can have a system where that the government can be extremely involved in the affairs of its citizens, and still achieve a lot of economic growth, and maybe democracy and free markets. Democracy with free markets is probably is not the only option that will probably lead us to growth. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I completely agree that democracy is not the only route to economic growth and human well-being. Having said that, the social science evidence clearly indicates that on average, democracy is a safer bet. So yes, you know, if you are a Chinese citizen, especially in the eastern part of the country, you could think, wow, I mean, we are so much more affluent than we were two or three generations ago. This is great. On the other hand, if you were a Uyghur in Western China and you had been subjected to great persecution and maybe put into these massive internment camps, you wouldn't think that this system is so good.
You touched upon this a little bit. I just want to polish this a little bit, or if you have more to say on this, which is the role of international order in, let's say, influencing emerging democracies or dictatorships, maybe the role of the US, and maybe going forward, as we touched upon a little bit, the role of China as well going forward.
Right. I mean, democracy promotion is very difficult. Because the US and the European Union are generally cautious about how they intervene in other countries. I think, you know, the most successful democracy promotion program in history was the European Union's efforts to support democratization first in Southern Europe in the 1970s, Spain, Portugal, and Greece, and then in Eastern Europe after the fall of communism. So this is especially the belt of countries such as Czechoslovakia in the 90s. It's now the Czech Republic and Slovakia, Poland, Hungary, Romania, Bulgaria. In the 90s, for some time in the Western Hemisphere, the combination of liberal democracy and not open markets, but let's say, you know, market-oriented capitalism reigned supreme. And for that short period of time, the U.S. and the Organization of American States were pretty successful at deterring authoritarianism. But it was a fairly short period. China's rise as the other great superpower in the world has meant several things for competition between democracies and authoritarianism. First, you know, China's rise has meant that autocrats, authoritarian rulers who want loans, who want direct foreign investment, they don't need to rely on the West. And secondly, China's rise as a superpower has also meant that there's an attractive model out there for autocratic leaders. They can point to China and say, we want to be like that. We want stability. We want economic growth. We want authoritarian rule that will preserve stability. So those are a few, at least, opening thoughts in answer to your question.
What do you think? What do you think all this means to the U.S., though? I mean, how do you think the U.S. should think about it, or also maybe what kind of response maybe should it probably have?
Yes. Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, I hate to say this because I have a deep conviction that democracy is the best form of government, maybe not everywhere and every time, but on average, is it the best form of government? I think the evidence is very clear that it is. But I think the U.S. today has to be cautious about promoting democracy. I don't mean that it can't do it, but it's got to be very cautious, especially in the aftermath of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Why do I say that? Because it's important to not alienate countries that could be, it's important to not alienate autocratic countries that have a friendly relationship with the United States. The world today, you know, we see this especially with Russia's brutal invasion of Ukraine. It's a tough place. The rise of China as the second great superpower, that alone meant that, I think it made it more difficult to engage in, let's call them, naive democracy promoting programs. I think the zenith of naive democracy promoting programs in the U.S. occurred in the George W. Bush administration. The idea that the United States could promote democracy in Afghanistan, right? I mean, that was not the main reason the United States invaded Afghanistan. The main reason was, of course, that, you know, the Taliban had supported a terrorist attack against the United States. But Afghanistan, I mean, that was a place where the probability of democracy was always extremely low. And likewise, I mean, the invasion of Iraq in 2003, for U.S. interests in a very narrow way, was a terrible idea, right? I mean, it was based on a lie. It was based on a lie that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And probably the U.S. leaders that promoted the invasion of Iraq, they probably believed that. But there was a lot of evidence that should have led them to doubt it. And then after they discovered that there were no weapons of mass destruction, they said, well, you know, now our goal is promoting democracy. But promoting democracy in a country where the conditions for democracy were extremely deficient, right? I mean, that's just not going to work. So in a world during the short period, let's say roughly 1990 to roughly 2005, when there was a unipolar world with US and EU hegemony, the upside of democracy promotion was greater and the risks were less. But in today's world, right, which is a world of very intense competition, the risks of, right, what you don't want to do is alienate countries and push them toward Russia or China.
Do you miss the days of unipolar, you know, that unipolar power where, you know, US was dominant? Or do you think the world where we have multiple superpowers or, you know, multiple strong economies or, you know, nations that can influence geopolitics, do you prefer to live in that world, or do you like the world of, you know, 2000 pre-Iraq war maybe?
Well, you know, I mean, of course, this depends entirely on my own normative judgments, but I think that China's rise as an economic power has been, in a lot of ways, good for the world, but China's rise as a political superpower has not been good, because it has made it easier to foster authoritarianism. So, to my mind, I personally believe that the George W. Bush administration's foreign policy was very misguided, and it was a world of imposition and using, in the case of Iraq, military invasion.
I think I've heard it in a lecture, if I'm not wrong, that Iraq war was like the pre-Iraq war was like the height of US dominance in the world. So Iraq war was one event where I think the trust of the US globally started to deteriorate immensely after that. And I think 2007 financial crisis was another event which made the world very suspect of, you know, US dominance and US. Are you sympathetic to that view?
I completely agree with you. I would probably emphasize the invasion, the very misguided invasion of Iraq, more than the economic crisis in 2007 to 2009. But I think you're right. Both of those eroded the image of the United States in the world.
On the Russian invasion, were you surprised by the response, the international response of the Russian invasion to Russian invasion of Ukraine, in the sense that I think India, if I'm not wrong, my understanding is India has not condemned the invasion, nor has have multiple countries. Were you expecting that, you know, there would be a much stronger front on the resistance to that war? Were you surprised by the response?
I'm not terribly surprised. What is maybe more surprising is how unified the EU response has been, and how impressive the EU-US alliance has held so far. I think there's a real risk that could erode. Why was I not more surprised that, for example, you know, India, I mean, India has always maintained a position of neutrality. You know, going back to the Cold War, you would know more about this than I, but, you know, I mean, India, I think, maintained a position of relative neutrality during the Cold War. And we today look at the Soviet Union and think, you know, it was a horrific regime that brutalized its own citizens. And what the West offered, of course, was much, much better. But so India has traditionally had a position of neutrality. So,
but I think not taking a stance or, you know, not criticizing itself is not a, is a stance, right? I mean, you're saying that you won't, I mean, by saying that you will not criticize, you're already taking like a side.
Of course.
That's what I feel. Yeah.
I'm disappointed in the response of some countries. For example, Brazil. I mean, I would have expected Brazil's current president, I would have hoped that he would have been more incisive in criticizing the Russian invasion. But he hasn't been.
Does this, I mean, so is this, was the Russian invasion of Ukraine, was this like the event where the world got to see how maybe divided the world really is? I mean, was this that event where people, like a lot of people came to know that, you know, the dominance of the US, not in the dominance of the US, but I mean, the world is more split than people would assume. So do you feel that, or?
I think it has sharpened the division, but I think it was clear even well before the Russian invasion of Ukraine that we had moved to a very different world, right? I mean, so if you think about global, about international regimes, there was a clear international regime from 1946 to 89, right? That was the Cold War. And that pitted fundamentally capitalism against communism, the U.S. and Western Europe against mostly the Soviet Union, since China was a very, very poor country for that time. And then you had another period from, let's say, roughly 1991, the dissolution of the Soviet Union, until around 2005, which was a unipolar world. Now, by the 2010s, I think it was clear that that unipolar dominance, the U.S. hegemony and Western European hegemony, had clearly eroded. The Russian invasion of Crimea in 2014, I think, was a clear indicator of the fact that the world had changed. Or the Russian invasion of Georgia in 2008. But other indicators included, for example, I mean, if you look at Latin American or African trade with China or foreign Chinese direct foreign investment, I know more about the Latin American side than the African side. But, you know, most Latin American countries, for a century, their primary trade partner was the United States. Today, many Latin American countries, their first trade partner is China. And so, you know, people who paid attention saw, yes, there was a dramatic change in the world between the 1990s and the 2010s. However, you're absolutely correct. You know, Putin's invasion of Ukraine has sharpened this division.
You mentioned trade. What are the dynamics of trade? What is the relationship maybe between trade and a political system? Like, I mean, does it not only within a political system, but also maybe across? What are the dynamics of trade? Maybe when maybe even an authoritarian regime is trading with a democratic regime, are there fascinating results there, or are there some things to be wary about? It's a weird question, but yeah.
Well, I mean, I'm not an expert on this topic at all, but one thing that the Trump administration did, I thought Donald Trump was a bad president, but the Biden administration has continued this policy, and I think it's correct, is to be cautious about supply chains. So, for example, you know, the United States today should not be vulnerable to disruptions in supplies from China because of the potential of, right, the U.S. warned Germany for years about German dependence on Russian oil and natural gas imports. And the Russian leaders, I think, unwisely didn't pay attention. And so when all of a sudden, you know, well, I shouldn't say all of a sudden, because Russia first invaded Ukraine in 2014, but when Russia launched the full-scale invasion last February, right, it was a wake-up bell for Germany and the rest of Western Europe. No, this was a stupid mistake. We cannot let our citizens' lives be dependent on the whims of Vladimir Putin. So, you know, I do think that it's not a simple question of trading between authoritarian and democratic regimes. The big question is this an authoritarian regime that will use its economic leverage for blackmailing?
But that's going to be very difficult, I think. No, I mean, in terms of U.S. and China trade relations, I think, especially, I mean, not only the U.S., but I think any country who's trading with China, I mean, China produces so much of almost, I think, everything. And it's going to be very difficult to, I think, what is that? At least on the supply chains per se, it's going to be very difficult to regrow those industry or, you know, restart those industries back in maybe the U.S. or, you know, move them somewhere else. It's going to be, I think, a very complicated task.
It's a very complicated task, and it leads to economic inefficiencies compared to just, you know, more open markets. But I think what, you know, the question for policymakers who deal with trade is what is the list of products that would leave us very vulnerable to blackmail, right? I mean, so for example, I drink a lot of high quality green tea from China. I drink most of my black tea from all of my black tea is from India, but I drink a lot of green tea from China. But would my life take a terrible turn for the worse if the green tea market from China were closed? Well, my life, I would be disappointed, but you know, I could live with it, right? I get other good green tea from Nepal and from Vietnam. But computer chips, that's a different thing. Right. So this is not a situation like, I mean, El Salvador in the last few years has devolved into an authoritarian regime. But the United States doesn't, I think, need to worry about whether, you know, El Salvador would withhold products from the U.S. market to try to blackmail the United States. Right. When I say blackmail, I mean, what I mean in the example of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Putin hoped that natural gas and oil would prevent a unified European response in supporting Ukraine. Well, he ended up in the short term, over the last 13 months, he was wrong about that. That hasn't happened. But so, you know, there are some products for the United States, computer chips, I would say, is probably one that it's in this era of heightened competition, heightened global competition, right? It would be foolish for the United States or for any country not to think about what are the strategic goods that we absolutely must be able to produce ourselves or import from friendly countries.
I think the U.S. has also kind of woken up to this. No, I think I had read some news reports where I think they were trying to move some semiconductor chip companies to the U.S. And I think they're doing some work there.
Yes, you're exactly right. So that's why I used that example. That's exactly right.
Right. I'm just thinking, now that you mentioned this, because there is the rise of China, which is kind of authoritarian. I'm just curious if that would rally the US and the democracies all over the world to not form like a coalition per se, but because you see the enemy in sight, there might be more proponents of democracy or just reaching out to other countries which might be on the cusp. Or do you think that factor or that dynamic might play out?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I don't have a great answer for you. I would say so far the evidence works against that. Why do I say that? Because, you know, as China, concomitant with China's rise, occurred a sharp turn in an authoritarian direction in the Republican Party in the United States. So, I mean, this was partially exemplified with Donald Trump. To some degree, it anteceded Trump. But at the state level, for example, the Republican Party began voter suppression efforts. So, you know, the Republican Party in the 2000s began to try to disqualify mostly Black voters from voting. They made it harder for Black voters to vote. They also, I mean, both parties do this, but maybe the Republicans even more so engage in these. Do you know the word gerrymandering?
I've heard it multiple times, but I don't know what it means.
Yeah, so, I mean, like India, the United States has single-member districts for our lower chamber of Congress, for the House of Representatives. Every decade, these districts, after the census, these districts are redrawn. But now, they are, in most states, they are redrawn to give the party in power at the state level a massive electoral advantage. So, for example, I mean, part of this is just, this isn't all the product of gerrymandering, but I remember reading some years ago that in Pennsylvania, I'm not sure I have the numbers exactly right, but I believe that the Democrats won a majority of the vote for the House of Representatives, but they won only 5 of 18 seats. So if you draw the districts, in you can use computers to draw districts, right, in a way that super magnifies your electoral advantages. In the state of Wisconsin, I've read some statisticians and political scientists' estimates that to win a majority, right, the Republicans engaged in massive gerrymandering. So to win a majority, the Democrats would need to win about of seats. The Democrats would need to win about 2/3 of the votes.
Isn't that like election manipulation? It sounds, I don't know, the way you're explaining it sounds like that.
That's exactly what it is. Okay. Gerrymandering is a term for, it's a specific term for electoral manipulation. Yes.
I'm sure it was formulated for a good reason, but I think now, I think because, I don't know, at this point, I think it's just been used and abused, I think, I don't know.
There are all these used. It's used and abused. And I mean, you know, the zenith of the Republican Party's turn to authoritarianism was, of course, Donald Trump's claim in after the 2020 election, which he lost, that he had won. And many, many Republicans supported this claim, even though a lot of them who supported it knew that he had lost. That's what authoritarians do. They do not recognize electoral defeats.
Understood. I want to switch gears a little bit. Since the crumbling of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, 28 mostly new states have abandoned communism. But only 8, the Czech Republic, Estonia, Hungary, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, Slovenia, and Croatia have entered the ranks of liberal democracies. The remaining majority of new post-communist states are various shades of dictatorships or unconsolidated transitional regimes. This is a broad question, but one that I have to ask is, what lessons did you learn from seeing this unfold or maybe just reading about this?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think there are multiple lessons. One is that democracy is hard, right? I mean, some powerful players, right? Democracy restricts power. by definition, that's part of what it does. And some powerful players, some powerful actors, individuals and business groups and mafia groups benefit from not having power restricted. They benefit from not having accountability. So that's one really important lesson, that democracy is hard. And a second lesson is that democracy is harder under some conditions than it is under others. And here we could revert to the modernization argument, right? So Central Asia, places like Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, right? These were much poorer at the dissolution of the Soviet Union than Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. So the conditions for democracy in Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia were much better than they were in places like Kyrgyzstan, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan. I could go on. I think there are more lessons than those two, but those are certainly two of the most important lessons, right? Democracy, it around 1990, a really important political scientist named Francis Fukuyama wrote a book proclaiming the definitive triumph of capitalism and democracy. But I mean, I have immense respect for Francis Fukuyama, but that book was delusional.
Okay. Before we get to Fukuyama, I think I have one on. I think I have a question on him. But you mentioned democracy is hard. What do you think can make it easier? I mean, is there some things that nations can do to maybe make the transition easier, or just make their life easier if they do certain things that democracy can be easy to manage?
Yeah, no, it's another great question. I mean, there's no simple recipe for doing this, but effective governance, of course, makes democracy easier. By effective governance, I mean things like, you know, providing good public security, improving education, improving health. We know that democracy on average does better than authoritarian regimes on average at most of these things. But if democracy fails to deliver, it opens space for authoritarian populists, and it opens, you know, it creates disillusion, it creates disenchantment with disaffection among citizens. Disaffected citizens are more likely to turn to authoritarian populists. So that's one thing that should be done. I mean, another thing that is important and that connects to public security, but if you start as a new democracy, right, you inherit public security forces that were part of the old authoritarian regime. So it's a good idea. On the one hand, you know, you don't want to completely dismantle the security forces, because then you get crime, right? You get public disorder. On the other hand, what is really important is you want over time to displace some of the most abusive leaders of the security forces. So, you know, you want to promote in the security forces, you want to promote individuals who are committed to a democratic agenda, who are committed to not abusing human rights, who are committed to the difficult but really important challenge of protecting public order, but doing so in a way that does not entail massive abuse of rights. This is a place where a lot of democracies in the region that I know best, Latin America, have fallen woefully short. They just, you know, on the one hand, the security forces are in a country like even Mexico, which is a pretty developed country, right? There's massive collusion between parts of the security forces and criminal organizations. So that's terrible. Second, the security forces commit a lot of abuses. And third, public security has eroded terribly in the last 16 years. So that's at a smaller scale than saying, yeah, you need to govern effectively, but it's important.
So we started off with what, like, how can we make the transition easier for a democracy, or not? I mean, how can we make democracy easier? And then we touched upon good governance. I'm just curious about when a country maybe adopts democracy. Let's say, for the example of India, maybe you know, it was a colonial state, and then we inherited a few institutions from the British and modified some of them. Are there any, but every country might have a different past, and, you know, not every state might be colonial. They might have their own history. Do you see any unique prerequisites that a state should probably have, which will make that transition easier, or which will make that transition more difficult?
Well, you know, I do think that, again, so this is not about policies, but about inherited circumstances. You know, countries that are poorer and further from the West have a harder time with democratization. There's no question about it. One other thing to think about, though, is a lot of democracy promotion efforts have focused on building civil society. I think building civil society is important, but probably even more important is building a solid state. And that means, you know, trying to root out corruption. It also means fundamentally, if we go back and read the great work by Thomas Hobbes, Leviathan, or the great German sociologist Max Weber, the first thing that the state has to do is ensure public security, ensure public order, and protect domestic borders. I again come to the point that states, democratic states, they have to protect rights, but they also have to provide public security. That combination of protecting rights but promoting public security, it's a difficult combination, but it's essential. So thinking about how you do that, that's a place where a lot of, you know, not there wasn't a whole lot of democratic thinking about how do we get this piece right. Democracy promotion efforts, I think, generally didn't pay enough attention to this question.
Once a state becomes democratic, how much time do you think it takes to mature? I mean, the U.S. has been a democracy for, I think, I don't know, over 300 years, if I'm not wrong. India, I think, has been 75 years, if I'm not wrong. Do you think that there has to be a certain amount of time has to pass before institutions maybe mature, or there is enough of enough election cycles to go, enough election cycles that happen, and, you know, maybe it just naturally kind of it's kind of automated per se. The democracy is automated per se. Do you think there is like this maturation period, or nations can mature fast, or nations can mature very slowly as well?
Yes, I mean, I think the early democratizing countries, that was a very long process. So, for example, when I teach undergraduates, I use a book on democratization in Britain. And, you know, that process started even before then, but it starts to accelerate in 1832. And you don't have complete suffrage until 1928. So that's a very long process. And likewise, the process of making elections free and fair took a very long time. I don't think that's so true in late democratizing countries. So, for example, you know, if we looked at Chile and Uruguay in Latin America, Chile after 1990 and Uruguay after 1985, these were countries that, those were the years of redemocratization. These were countries that had a very long tradition of democracy before democratic breakdowns in 1973. And they pretty quickly, especially in Uruguay, rebuilt a fairly high level of democracy. Likewise, you know, Hungary, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Poland, after the fall of communism, fairly quickly built pretty solid democracies. But I also want to comment on one other part of your question, which is that even democracies that have been intact for a long time, they're less vulnerable to erosion and breakdown, but they're not invulnerable. There's no democracy that is perfectly invulnerable. In the US, there's a debate, you know, was democracy at risk because of Donald Trump? Before Donald Trump was president, no one in their right mind was even asking that question. I mean, it would have been viewed as a ludicrous question. My great colleague at Harvard, Steve Levitsky, and another Harvard political scientist, Daniel Ziblatt, wrote a fascinating book called How Democracies Die. And one of their fundamental arguments is that democracy in the US might be at risk. Other political scientists have disputed this and don't think that that's true. But if we look at what happened in Hungary after Viktor Orban came back to power in 2010, right? I mean, Hungary's a pretty wealthy country. It was a democracy that before 2010 looked very solid. So even pretty solid democracies can erode over time.
I want to make one digression. This is not related to, I mean, just on Trump in the sense that, and this may not be on democracy per se, which is just how you mentioned that Trump was, a lot of people started thinking how Trump was a danger to U.S. democracy. I kind of feel that, I feel George W. Bush did more damage to the U.S. In terms of, in multiple ways than I think Trump did in his 4 years. That's what at least I feel. Even though George W. Bush had, even though George Bush, I think, like he used to, his manner of speech, and I think, you know, he used to carry himself okay. But I felt Trump, I felt at least Trump, Bush did more damage to the US than Trump did in his 4 years. I think that's what I feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think Bush's foreign policy was more damaging than Trump's. But George W. Bush, you know, I was not a fan of Bush's at all, but I would put him certainly in the camp of Democrats, of small d Democrats. That is to say, you know, he wasn't someone, he would not have lost an election and claimed that he won.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
He would not have said to, you know, oh, let's use, Trump at times legitimized violence. And again, the quintessential example of that was January 6th, 2021, when he urged some of his far right wing supporters to engage in violence, when he encouraged them to engage in violence. Engaging in violence encouraging violence to overturn a free and fair election, I mean, that is an absolutely clear characteristic of authoritarian attitudes. George W. Bush never did anything like that.
You're saying, so all these, I mean, those things, what you mentioned, they mean a lot, but also, I'm also curious as to, how Trump was, you know, very rude to the media per se, or in a sense, he was very antagonist, I mean, very adversarial with the media. You think all those small things, they play a big role in maybe forming not only public opinion, but also how a country is perceived and how the state of the nation is kind of, you know, is perceived even internally? Do you think that matters a lot?
It matters some. I mean, you know, Trump often said that the media are the enemy of the people. Well, of course, you know, that now, I mean, Democrats, capital D Democrats, supporters of the Democratic Party in the U.S., didn't buy that rhetoric at all. But some of Trump's supporters did. And does this increase the chances of attacks on the media? Absolutely. And perhaps more importantly, you know, it reduces the credibility of honest media and increases the credibility of disinformation campaigns.
For mature democracies or for nations who have been democratic for a long time, you mentioned there is a chance for, democratic crumbling, but less so. What do you think, what are the factors that might contribute to those, democratic crumbling for a mature democratic state maybe?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to take the example of Hungary, this is evident that, you know, the Great Depression, the Great Recession of 2007-09 had a much more devastating effect on the Hungarian economy than it did on most economies. And that was certainly important in opening the doors for Orban, not only to win in 2010, but for him to build and retain support after that. A couple other more general points. One is that the era of social media has made it easier to disseminate false information. So authoritarians like, you know, Trump and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, who was president from 2019 to 2022, they thrive on the use of social media to disseminate false information. One other general point on this topic is that we've lived through decades of, I don't know how much this has changed in India, but in the advanced industrial democracies, we've lived through a period of accelerated cultural changes, changes in the role of women, changes in family structure, you know, more openness to gay people. And this has led to a backlash. So part of the authoritarian tendency in much of the advanced industrial democracies, part of it is a conservative backlash against these changing cultural norms, changing laws on these issues. One other general point, which I think is really important for the United States, and probably to some degree other places in the advanced industrial democracies. In the U.S., real median wages for workers have stagnated for 50 years. When I was in college, I worked two summers in a steel mill near where I lived. It was at that time one of the biggest steel corporations in the world, Bethlehem Steel. And the skilled workers at that time made $40,000 or $50,000 US dollars. And if you translate that, so I've looked at this, one $1,974 is worth about $4 today, roughly. I don't know exactly, but so that would mean today roughly $160,000 to $200,000. That's a high income. There are no workers in the United States today, except, you know, maybe some workers who own their own companies and have a lot of employees. Workers in the United States don't make anything close to that today. So the shrinking of life opportunities for a lot of the working class, or in a best case scenario, the lack of social mobility in the United States, the lack of opportunities for people to live upper middle class lives as workers. I mean, it's generated resentment. It's generated grievance. And, you know, someone like Donald Trump is really effective at mobilizing grievance. It's not just this grievance, you know, there are factors in life that make it possible to mobilize that grievance. But then Trump was extremely skillful at mobilizing the grievance.
I think that's also the reason why I think most of the world, I mean, at least the US and I think Europe, they have generally moved away from free trade agreements and maybe a sentiment which is anti-globalization as well. No? I think a lot of people have not really felt that benefit them. So I think that's also one of the symptoms, I think.
Absolutely. Absolutely right. And so you're absolutely correct. I mean, Trump moved away from free trade, mostly with China, and Biden has continued that policy.
Right. I want to read something from the syllabus of your course. Quote, in 1992, Francis Fukuyama published The End of History and The Last Man, proclaiming the triumph of liberal democracy over other political regimes. Although many were skeptical of his extraordinary optimism, it captured a mood that others shared at that time. Today, we can authoritatively proclaim that those who doubted that liberal democracy was vanquishing other regime types were right, unquote. What do you think kind of went wrong, and why did the people who were skeptical turn out to be right?
Well, I'd begin with something that I already said, which is that democracy is hard because it constrains interests. So if we take that as a beginning point, then, you know, looking at some democracies have new democracies born after the third wave started in 1974. Some have functioned really well, but most have not. And this easily gives rise to disaffection, to a search for, well, let's try something different. And so a really interesting example in today's world is El Salvador. It's a small country, so people in India probably wouldn't be too interested in it. But what makes it an interesting case is that El Salvador in the 90s and 2000s had one of the highest homicide rates in the world. And it remained very, very high until the current president came into office. And this president, his name is Nayib Bukele, he came into office. He's presided over an erosion of democracy, very powerful erosion of democracy. But he's also been pretty effective at improving public security. So people love him. And the lesson is that if democracies fail at generating what people need, they will be vulnerable.
Right. Just to polish that, and maybe you touched upon this in the sense, how should we think about populist leaders and maybe populist movements with its effects to democracy or dictatorship?
Right. Well, you know, populists are essentially, by definition, they reject the liberal dimension of democracy. They proclaim that they are the true representatives of the people. And they reject the liberal dimensions, such as, well, in particular, two checks on executive power and rights such as freedom of the press. So, you know, populists typically proclaim that the free press is the enemy of the people. Having said that, so all populists are, to some degree, in inexorable tension with democracy, but there's variance in how much and in how successful they are in attacking democracy. Some populists, you know, they want to slightly weaken checks and balances. They want to slightly weaken liberal rights. but they're not determined to undermine democracy. But other populists are full-scale authoritarians. A great example of this is the now deceased president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez. Chavez was president from 1999 until his death in 2013. And he was absolutely determined to completely undermine democracy and install an authoritarian regime. He was successful at doing that.
He was widely popular as well, no?
Pardon me?
He was widely popular as well, no? If I'm not wrong.
Well, he initially won the presidency in a landslide in 1998. And then his popularity waned. But he manipulated election timing so that he postponed a recall referendum until after the great commodity boom started. By then, the Venezuelan economy was recovering, so he was able to win. He was not wildly popular, but he was popular enough to win mostly free and fair elections. But the elections became less free and fair over time as he shut down the free press. And then his successor, you know, really engineered a project of destroying the country, not only destroying democracy, but destroying
the successor.
His name is Nicolas Maduro.
Maduro, yeah.
Okay. 2013. So, you know, if you looked at data on per capita GDP in Venezuela, I believe it's correct to say that there's no country in the world that has experienced a more severe economic downturn without a civil war or an external war than Venezuela. There's also been a massive humanitarian crisis with an exodus of about a quarter of Venezuela's population in the last 5 or 6 years. So if that happened in India, right, 350 million people would be leaving the country.
I'm just curious, like, what country do you think has done worse? Because I've seen videos of, I think Argentina as well, or I'm not too familiar with Venezuela, but which country economically do you think has done worse, Argentina or Venezuela?
Venezuela by far.
Okay. Then it must have done very bad, because I think I'd watched a video of Argentina's economy, and that itself was very devastating. It was very sad to watch.
No, Venezuela. I mean, I think it was in the year 2018, Venezuela had a hyperinflation of at least several 100,000% in 1 year.
Uh-huh, okay.
Just to give you an idea.
Right, yeah. What lessons can be learned from the rise of military dictators in Latin America to the movement out from under, from military dictatorship to, I think some countries have moved out of military dictatorship, and I think I have tried different types of political organizations as well. So are there any lessons that we can pick up from those transitions or from that time?
Right. Well, those transitions occurred decades ago in pretty much all cases. Well, one lesson is that the military dictatorships themselves varied greatly. So you had, you know, a dictatorship like Argentina's that was a tremendous failure in every respect. You had other dictatorships such as Chile and Brazil, which the Chilean dictatorship was pretty brutal. And if you looked at average per capita GDP growth under that dictatorship, it was not very effective, but if you looked at how it reoriented the Chilean economy, it was very effective. So the first two decades under democracy in Chile, economic growth and social improvement were very, very rapid. And that was partially because of very sound policies under democracy, but it was also partially because the Chilean dictatorship reoriented the economy in some fruitful directions toward a more open economy, more competitive economy, more export oriented, more efficient economy, and so forth. So you know, I mean, the legacies of the dictatorship varied greatly by country.
What do you think is the role of institutions in either transitioning to democracy or for a democracy to survive?
Right. Well, the two main institutions that you want to make sure are functional are first the state, and we've talked some about that, right? Having a functional state is essential for a democracy that functions well and that satisfies citizen needs. The second thing is having solid parties, right, is also really useful for democracy. Because if you have a solid party system, it helps order, it helps clarify choices for citizens, it helps with political accountability and responsibility, and it also makes it harder for outsiders, for populist authoritarians to come to power.
What is the role of the voter? What advice would you give to the voter to think effectively on these issues?
Well, of course, voters, you know, what they mostly do is vote in according to their own worldview and interests. But one thing I would say to voters is democracies might not always function well. They don't always function well. But don't forget that authoritarian regimes also have their problems, right? Authoritarian regimes can be extremely predatory. They can be extremely corrupt. They can be extremely oriented toward benefiting a very narrow elite. And who cares about the broader population? So, I mean, I don't know that that's going to be very persuasive to many voters, but it's something that I wish voters, that's the way to put it. I wish voters would remember that, even though I don't think they will.
I think on that note, Scott, thank you so much for taking the time. It was wonderful having you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the great questions.